Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. She also teaches at the med school here in Urbana-Champaign. And every other month, on a Monday, she is here, and we talk about women's health. She usually comes prepared to talk about maybe a couple of things that she'd like you to know about, or maybe some things that are in the news. But the idea here, the reason we do the program also, is to give people who are listening an opportunity to ask questions, and we certainly welcome them. The thing that I always say when we have doctors here on the program is that callers must understand there's a limit to what the doctor can do because she can't see you. We can't do diagnosis over the phone, but we do these shows. Hopefully they have an educational purpose, and they give people some basic information and allow you to ask some questions. And then, of course, if there's you got a problem, you need to pursue that with someone who can see you. But certainly your questions are welcome, and I know that she'll do her best to give you some information. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, locally 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Are there some particular things you might like to talk a little bit about to get us started here?
Yes, I thought I would talk about the new Halo Breast Pap Test. It's a new screening test for precancerous changes of the breast, just like we have a pap test for the cervix that is to detect precancerous changes of the cervix to ward off, to treat that and ward off cervical cancer. We're hoping that this can be a potential treatment to actually lower our rates of breast cancer. We also have a newly approved drug for the treatment of the second most common metabolic bone disease, Paget's disease of the bone, and it has also been studied in osteoporosis of menopausal women, and it's a drug called Reclast, and it's a once-a-year treatment for bone disease, and we are still involved in testing it in menopausal women. So I thought I would talk a little bit about that. We have some new contraception alternatives that I thought I would talk about as well. And perhaps we would get some phone calls, some new things in dieting. There was, of course, the new over-the-counter Ali that they've started to have. That's available for diets. It's a fat blocker, actually, and it's a over-the-counter dosage form of Orlistat, which has been available by prescription for a few years. So there's quite a bit new. I have the feeling I was supposed to look up a couple of things from 2 months ago, but my every 2 month system, I need to get the hang of that. 20 years at once a month, I need to get the hang of it. So there's somebody I was supposed to look something up for. I think an email might be better. I get the feeling I was supposed to, I had an assignment I didn't do, but maybe I did it, and I'll remember that. Okay. I think we might even have a caller. So,
well, it does look like we're getting somebody lined up here. Again, questions are certainly very welcome. That's the idea. That's the idea behind doing these programs on a regular basis, to give you a chance to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here, someone on a cell phone. We will get right to them on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about anemia. I just had some blood work done last week, and they told me that my hemoglobin is 9.7, and it's supposed to be 11-14. So my doctor prescribed a iron supplement for me to take, and I'm taking 65-milligram pills 3 times a day. And I was just wondering, what's an unsafe level of iron? The daily recommended dose is way lower than that, I think, and I just was curious, you know, at what point you can become unsafe.
You mean what would be too much to take in a supplement? Well, in a relatively young, healthy person, it would be unusual to, if you're going with a recommended medical supplement, it would be very unusual to be able to take an unsafe level when you're trying to get your count to be boosted up.
Right.
And usually a monthly regimen is about what it takes. Repliva, which is the newest form of prescription iron, has discovered that we do better if we try to give a boost of iron and then kind of back off a little bit. And it's not just iron, but we sometimes often need B vitamins to boost our count. And so Repliva has a new formulation that they've nicknamed 217, kind of like the way we have given birth control pills in the past. Now we've moved away a little bit from the 217 formulation of birth control pills, but they give you 21 days of the iron, and then you actually have 7 days where you take other types of vitamins and not just iron. And get your body to let some of the iron absorption sites desaturate so that you can pick up again and absorb. And actually, you had a low hemoglobin count, but the vast majority of individuals that actually need some iron don't necessarily have a low hemoglobin count, but they may just have low ferritin levels, so low iron stores, even though their hemoglobin hasn't dropped. And for some people, taking oral iron is so rough on their system that intravenous iron is actually becoming very popular. And years ago, the only way we could give intravenous iron was so harsh that allergic reactions were very common, and it just was very, very difficult to administer, rough on the veins, and just a lot of physicians don't use it. But there are two different research companies working on ways that they've reformulated chemically the iron that can be given so that it's very easy, very tolerable. A quick push of infusion can get the iron in your system, and boom, sometimes just even one treatment or possibly two, and you're done. You don't need weeks and weeks of iron therapy. And really, that's going to revolutionize the way we treat anemias, either postpartum or from bleeding. And that's really the flip side of the coin, not that you're anemic, but why were you anemic? Was there something wrong with your diet? Were you having heavy periods or something else?
Well, that's what we haven't figured that out yet. So I do need to go back in 2 weeks, and they're going to recheck my blood count and all that. So I was, and how low? I mean, I didn't even feel bad. That's the thing. I just went to the doctor, had blood work done because I hadn't had any done in a while. And I don't even feel bad. That's the thing. I just thought, at what point would I start feeling bad?
And that's an excellent question. And for some people, the iron loss is rapid. So, for instance, if somebody was walking around with normal count and something happened, let's say they cut themselves and they bled a lot and they went from a normal count of 14 down to a 9, that person would feel extremely lightheaded, and they probably would have symptoms. But if something was occurring over time, let's say their diet had just kind of gotten worse and worse and worse, and their count had gone down from a regular count to a 9 something over months, but even possibly over years, you would get used to it, and you just wouldn't even know that you were running around low, and you just learn to live with it. And some patients walk in extremely low blood counts, and the physicians and healthcare providers that take care of them say to the patient, "Don't you feel terrible?" And the patients are like, "No, I feel fine." But some people just learn to cope with their symptoms. But others feel very symptomatic at even slight abnormalities. So a lot has to do with what else you're doing. You know, maybe you get good sleep or something else to compensate.
Okay, thanks.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We have certainly time for others. If you'd like to call in and talk with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen, she is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She's on the program every other month to talk about women's health particularly, and if you have questions about her, you know, her area of practice, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
one thing that was interesting in one of the studies we were doing, we found that actually a significant percentage of postpartum depression is due to anemia. Hmm. And that is one of the first things that we look for in our patients that complain of postpartum depression. So not all postpartum depression is just this non-specific baby blues. Some of it is actually medically based, and it could be anemia, it could be thyroid disorders, it could be something like that. So those kinds of things are very important to check.
Well, is that, I guess then that would be my question, is when women are showing symptoms of postpartum depression, if that's, and if maybe they're going to their family doctor, is it common practice to do a blood test and to check for iron deficiency?
Well, you know, for a long time, that was one of the problems. People would be like, oh, you've been up late with the baby. You just aren't getting enough rest. You know, it's a big change in your family. Oh, it's normal. It's nothing. And I think that we've moved more and more towards not writing it off and actually doing both a medical evaluation and actually screening more for trying to figure out those patients that are having a significant problem versus those patients that are just a little bit sleep deprived.
Okay. Well, again, other folks who are listening have questions, you can give us a call. Well, why don't we talk about some of the topics that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and I'm particularly interested in hearing about this pap test for the breast.
And we've known for a while that if a woman has a discharge from her breast, that it is possible to send that discharge off and get a pap test, and that sometimes that pap test can be interpreted such that it can give us findings that would be helpful in managing that discharge. But now we have learned that when a breast cancer is picked up on a mammogram, we find that it's probably been in a woman's body for somewhere between 8 and 12 years. We've kind of used the average number of years as 10 years. And so that when we are finding these early cancers on mammogram, yes, they're very treatable, but they are actually cancers. So like with cervical disease, the breast ducts themselves do, we have discovered, undergo this many-year process, somewhere between 1 and 6 year process of precancerous changes that we can possibly identify and arrest in development, so that we can ideally identify many patients that are truly the most high risk and perhaps even reverse these changes in those patients. Because we have done these studies, and we've talked about them before, where we have given patients that are in the most high-risk categories medications like tamoxifen, and now there's this new medication, raloxifene, that we use for osteoporosis treatment in menopausal patients. We have given patients this, and we've noticed that we've been able to prevent breast cancers, and yet over 80% of patients that are eligible for those treatments haven't been taking them. So we're starting to put all of this together, and we've decided that we really need a way to identify the most high-risk patients and identify these precancerous changes in the breast. And clearly, a plain old breast exam doesn't do it, and a plain old mammogram doesn't do it, and a plain old ultrasound hasn't done it. None of these other tests that we've talked about over these past number of years that we've talked on this show, thermograms, we've had the T-scan test that they were trying to work on. We haven't identified any blood tests for the breast, but this new pap test for the breast called the HALO test seems to be extremely accurate, and it's a 5-minute test. It's something that can be administered to virtually anyone, whether she has a breast implant or not, whether she's young or she's old, and it's a machine. It looks somewhat like a breast pump. The machine has pedals. The pedals are somewhat cushioned. They're placed on the breast, and they use a warming technique and a massage technique to get fluid from the nipple, and the amount of fluid is literally a drop, and that drop is then sent off for a pap smear analysis, just the way we would collect just a droplet of cells off the cervix. And if that if the patient does not produce any fluid, she's done for the year. If she does produce fluid and the droplet is sent off, if the droplet has no cells at all, that's a normal test. If the cells are just normal breast cells, that's also a normal test. If the cells are hyperplastic, it's actually not considered a significant, but if they're atypical, it's considered significant, and she is a candidate for further evaluation or perhaps even a mammogram if she's very young, or perhaps a treatment like with Evista or tamoxifen if she's older, perhaps an MRI of the breast to do something to see if we can identify a cancer that has not yet been identified. So it's a pap smear test for the breast. Okay. And being a new test, all new tests in the United States do not yet get an actual code assigned to them by insurance companies. And then once they move into more established tests, they will get a code. And then the insurance company has to decide if they're going to pick up that code and reimburse. Once fluid's produced, it just gets sent like a regular pap. So the pap part of the test is usually covered by virtually every insurance. But the actual collection of the fluid, and there are some disposables, the pedals that are placed on the machine, are, you know, each patient gets a set of pedals unique to herself. Those are disposables, so there is some cost in running the test itself. So there is some cost that insurance companies aren't yet picking up. But it is a test that can be done, particularly in the age 25 to 40-year-old age group that you're not even doing mammograms on most of these patients at all. But they're saying very specifically for ages 25 to 55, it's probably significantly more accurate even than a mammogram. Over the age of 70, at that point in time, those precancerous changes, a significant percent of patients probably have even moved past that stage, and mammograms start to become so accurate because there's so much breast atrophy. They think that maybe mammograms are more accurate, but just like we do a pap smear and a pelvic exam, they are anticipating pap smear and mammogram for patients. So it's going to be ideally part of the physical exam for all patients, but it's very, very new. I have the first machine in Illinois, and it's a company called Neomatrix. They have a great website, lots of really good information on there about the test and about some of these changes within the ductal cells. And I'm hoping that more patients will find out about it. Patients tend to think that if they haven't had a family member with breast cancer, they're not at risk, but 1 in 7 American women are at risk, and 8 out of 10 breast cancers occur in women without a family member that has had breast cancer. So breast cancer really, truly does affect all American women, and this is really the first true breakthrough in detection of breast disease and prevention of breast cancer. And especially for people on hormones as they get into menopause and as they stay on hormones 5 years, 10 years, however long they're going to, I think that it's a terrific test to be able to determine whether they can continue on these hormones safely for many years. So it's an exciting new breakthrough in health.
Just as a general kind of question, and then I will get right onto a conscious. As a general kind of question, if a woman is noticing some discharge from her breast, is that the kind of thing where you would say, don't just say, oh, well, and ignore that? Is that a sign that you might be having a problem and you should
Well, the discharge could be due to a variety of factors. It may or may not be associated with something precancerous. It may very likely be associated with galactorrhea. By doing the HALO test, however, with the massaging of the petals, they're bringing fluid up from deeper glands. So it's a little bit different than just doing an exam and eliciting discharge.
Okay. Let's take a call here. We have someone in Mattoon to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling about osteoporosis. And I wondered if you have done any EMT magnetic therapy for bones. I've read this just lately.
I haven't been involved in it. I have looked at some of those studies and not completely convinced by the studies that they've had. Definitely the magnetic therapy can help reduce some pain and particularly arthritic pain, but I haven't seen any convincing magnetic studies that have improved bone density. To actually improve bone density, we probably need to rely on effective calcium dosage, vitamin D dosage, either with or depending on the patient, with or without one of the commonly available medications.
Well, I take Avista, and I've off of Premarin for 4 years, but I've lost height a lot.
Okay, height is a combination of factors. Some patients who have lost height have spinal fractures, and it's important to get an evaluation for whether or not you have spinal fractures.
Well, I did that.
Yeah, and it could also be compression of the discs between the vertebra themselves, and people can lose a great deal of height due to that.
Well, it's worrying me because, if you're getting worse, shorter all the time.
Well, if for people on bone therapies, they need to have continuing evaluation. They need to find out if they have adequate vitamin D levels. They need to find out if they have adequate calcium levels. Is their bone turnover really suppressed to an adequate level? And is their bone turnover suppressed too much? And if they have scores that are in the dramatically low range, are they candidates for bone building medication? Avista helps to retard bone loss, but it doesn't help to build bone. And that is only done by a medication called Forteo. So you need that's a parathyroid hormone called Forteo. PTH. It's an injection. PTH. It can only be given over 2 years, usually given by specialists. There are some family medicine physicians that work with it. There are some endocrinologists that work with it. There are some internists that work with it. And you may want to talk to the physician that's prescribing Avista and find out if your physician does work with Forteo, or if not, you could perhaps be referred to a physician that does. At least have a consult.
Well, what about going back on hormones?
Most patients do not utilize estrogen therapy strictly for bone health unless there's another reason to use estrogen. So that if another medication is used and it's just modest bone loss, it's usually a bisphosphonate. And in fact, about 85% of women getting therapy for osteoporosis are on bisphosphonates.
I was, too.
Yeah.
But then I'm on Avista. Whether that's not it, is it?
Avista is a SERM, and it's an excellent medication because it has some anti-breast cancer properties. So it is an excellent medicine. Now, we're involved in testing Reclast, and we are looking for patients that might be interested in being involved in some of those clinical trials. So you can call our office to see if you would qualify, but if you've been on a bisphosphonate, probably you wouldn't qualify for that trial. But we always have other ones coming up.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. We are midway through this hour of Focus 580. We have two other calls we will get right to just as soon as I introduce again our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. She also has a private practice here in our area in obstetrics and gynecology. Every other month, she is here on the program on a Monday and answers questions about women's health. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here to talk with in Chicago. Line 4. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Mm-hmm. Truppen?
Yes.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling because I was on hormone therapy for 10 years. From the age of 48 to 58. And my gynecologist, who I had for 32 years, a Harvard graduate and someone I trusted quite strongly, retired. And he told me for the rest of my life that I should take Premarin Provera at a very low dose, which he gave to me every other day in two different pills. Well, the Women's Initiative study came out, and it opposed the original study that he based his theory on, that it was good for my heart, it was good in prevention of strokes, it was good in bone health. Well, now the doctor that I have, the new one, said that the Women's Initiative study has concluded that it is not good for your heart, and yes, it's still good for your bones. Well, I tell you, I have deteriorated quite a lot since I've stopped taking this hormone therapy. And now my cardiologist said my cholesterol has gone up, and that's due to hormonal changes. I'd like your opinion on this, because now there's a new study, if you take estrogen alone, that it is good for your heart and your bones, definitely. I don't have a problem with breast cancer. I've been taking mammograms every year, and my gynecologist, who retired, said if I did not have a history of cancer in my family, I did not have to concern myself with that. And in 10 years, I never did have a problem with any bad side effects to hormone therapy.
And how long have you been off estrogen?
I'm going to be 60. It's been about a year and a half, but it was estrogen, progesterone. It was Prempro, really, but in different tablets taken every other day at the lowest dosage possible.
Okay. Well, you're asking a lot of fabulous questions, and in this setting, we can't really go into depth. But unfortunately, if you were taking an atypical strength of medicine in an atypical formulation, which you were, you can't really completely apply the current research to your own situation because you weren't really taking full strength. But let's just say that basically what you were is someone who took hormone therapy from menopause and continued on. And all the current reanalysis of Women's Health Initiative therapy says that in that group of patients, in fact, there was a lower risk of heart disease, not an increased risk of heart disease, and that it probably was cardioprotective in that group, and that group could be analyzed somewhat separately, and that to some extent, mixing the average patient in Women's Health Initiative who was a new start on hormone therapy with average entry age of 63 with a patient like yourself was a little bit mixing apples and oranges, and that really that for somebody that's really only been off about a year, if you got right back on, you probably could be considered somebody that could safely be on hormone therapy still for a fairly long stretch if you found the right physician to sit down and look over your individual case and decide risk-benefit-wise what you need to do. But you really need to sit down and decide, okay, what is your overall cardiovascular health picture? What's your weight? And don't answer all these questions right now. Sit down with your own healthcare provider. What's your weight? What's your exercise? What's your whole cholesterol profile? Not what's your total cholesterol, but what's your good? What's your bad? Really get your numbers in gear and what's going to be the best strategy to do that. And there's no doubt about it. All of us need our LDLs under 100. We need to be in the best shape that we can be. And probably doing that with statins instead of estrogen is better for all of us. And then depending on what you're going to do for your bones. Yes, estrogen is protective of your bones, but if there is truly no other reason, sexuality, vasomotor symptoms, some other reason to be on estrogens, most of us are going to treat our bones with other things. Now, also with respect to moods and things like that, well, again, something else may or may not be going along. But the Women's Health Initiative was kind of misinterpreted for individuals like yourself, although I don't know why your Harvard physician did his own thing with your dosing, but it was misinterpreted. It did sort of confirm that these treatments were very safe, but they were just a little bit less safe than what we thought. Because if you actually looked at the absolute risks, even in this well-done trial, the absolute risks in most of these cases were very low. And I think that for some patients, they were pulled off their therapy a little bit prematurely and not within the context of their whole medical case. And being pulled off their therapy, they weren't adequately then treated. I mean, they were being given therapy, and then once you stop that therapy, you may still need therapy in some of those other realms. So I think that where some of the mistakes were made is that once you came off that medicine, now you have to look at what else is going on. So once people are off of estrogen, for instance, with respect to bone, somewhere 12 to 18 months out, you get a bone density. Now you're down to baseline. So a bone density done while you're on hormone therapy is very different than the bone density that you're going to be getting 12 to 18 months off the therapy. And then you need to go from there with respect to your bones. So there's going to be a number of issues, but probably going to have to sort all this out with your own physician. But
so you don't feel that it would be dangerous to discuss this with my new gynecologist, because I have brought that up, and indicate to her whether it be the mood or be the bone density issue or the fact that my cholesterol has shot up, the LDL.
I have many patients in their late 50s, early 60s, safely on low-dose hormone therapy, safely and happily on low-dose hormone therapy.
Both progesterone and estrogen together?
I think that is probably still the best strategy for many patients. Now, there's about to be released a new product, Evamist, that is going to be a transdermal estrogen spray, and they think that they're going to have very, very low risks on the endometrial lining. I think that for patients that want to take a risk of endometrial lining cancer, some patients will want to drop the progesterone component of their hormone therapy. But I think you're trading some endometrial risk for some breast risk. And I think that it's a little bit premature. But if you really study the Women's Health Initiative data on the estrogen alone arm and the so-called breast protection, I don't think the data was that strong. And
that's what he said.
And I was not that impressed. I speak for them. And I teach doctors that data. And I think that that's a little bit of an overstatement. I don't think that breast protection is going to hold up. So I'm really not encouraging my patients to do estrogen only. But I do have a few of those patients as well.
Well, thank you very much. You've been very informative.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Let us
continue, and we'll talk next with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had a baby about 5 months ago, and I have been, my doctor says I've been pretty much like 30 pounds overweight for a while now. And I was hoping to figure out, is there a safe way to go on a diet, even while I'm still nursing? Or is that just basically, because I talked to the pediatrician, and she was like, don't go on a diet at all. But I kind of think there's something at this point now that I've established nursing and, you know, all that other stuff, that I can safely do something with my diet that will help me lose some pounds while not compromising the nursing.
Well, I'm with you. I think that you can definitely start to lose some weight, especially if you're 30 pounds over. A lot has to do with your overall. Are you supplementing your baby at all, or zero at 5 months?
Very little, at most, like a bottle every other day, okay, or something like that.
Yeah, but no solids or anything quite yet.
Not yet.
So zero, but your milk supply is well in, and you're going to get a lot of clues from your baby about that, and you should be able to slowly lose your 30 pounds, and probably a good goal would be to try to lose those 30 pounds over the next year. And so if you do the math, and you've got 12 months to lose 30 pounds, so we're really talking about 3 pounds a month, so, you know, not very much weight loss.
Right.
And basically, it's an energy balance formula, and I strongly believe in figuring out how much you're using up and what you're taking in, and
Okay. Pretty
much working. I mean, I think that it's ideal to work with a nutritionist, but you know, that is not possible for everybody. But ideally, you figure out what you're taking in and what you're using up. They used to give the formula that pregnancy was worth about 350 calories a day, and that breastfeeding was worth 750 calories a day. And we all know that those are just way too high estimates. So, you know,
yeah,
but
that
you
would be awesome.
It would be, but you could probably count on breastfeeding being in the 200 to 300 calorie range, and
Okay. You
can probably count on a solid half an hour of exercise being in the 200 to 300 calorie expenditure range, and you can probably safely say that that if you're a pretty active individual, that you could probably burn up, you know, 15 to 2,000. You can start doing the math, and then you probably need to. We always say that it takes 3,500 calories to burn off a pound. So in your month of burning up 3 pounds, you have to burn off these 3 times 3,500, and you just start playing with the math. And there's great formulas like I think it's like eDiets.com or eFit,
okay,
and that's what they do at Weight Watchers. That's what nutritionists do.
Okay.
And that's where I even think this Ali is something fairly reasonable. One danger with Ali is that, being a fat blocker, certain vitamins are fat-soluble vitamins, so you might want to boost your, you know, you definitely wouldn't want to skip any of your vitamins, and you might even want to boost your general vitamin intake, but it causes about 1/3 of the fat to pass through. So if you're having, you know, black coffee and oatmeal, you don't bother taking it because there's no fat in that meal and won't do anything plus or minus. But if you're having a meal that is a piece of bread that has a little bit of fat and it has some butter on your bread, and maybe a little potato with a tiny bit of butter margarine, whatever you're eating on it, and you had a little bit of salad with maybe a little bit of cheese and maybe a little bit of salad dressing that has a little bit of fat and maybe a piece of meat, something like that. Well, there are some fat calories in that meal, and about 1/3 of them will just pass through.
Wow.
It'll be a little drippy, but some of that will just pass through.
Is that okay, I mean, to take something like that while I'm nursing?
You know, they haven't studied it. You're going to read the label, and they're going to be like, well, it hasn't been studied. And that's where you start saying, well, you know, it hasn't been studied. And that's where they say for, you know, nursing, what, you know, is it a potential harm? But that's what this new one is. And, you know, can you wait until you're done? Probably you you can. Uh-huh. But and just by literally doing your energy balance, that's what that's all about. With most of that true diet pills out there that you wouldn't want to take when you're nursing, but what they do is they're appetite suppressants. So if you if we do studies with and without appetite suppressants for most patients, if they stick to the diet, they lose the same with or without the appetite suppressant.
Okay.
Ali's different because it causes some of that fat not to be absorbed. But, and I haven't looked at the package insert, but I bet it's a C. I think it's a C. I haven't a category C drug, but I'll have, but read when you go to the grocery store, look. If it's a C, don't take it. If it's a B, you could probably take it.
Oh, okay.
But I think that, you know, that's probably what you want to do. But you could definitely, with your energy balance, try to slowly lose over the next year.
Was this, at least, was this a prescription?
No, it's over the counter. It used to be a prescription. It was Orlistat.
Okay.
It was in the 120 milligram dose. And the problem is that if you really cheat and you forget that you took your Ali and you're like, oh, what the hell? I'm really in the mood for McDonald's shake and French fries and Big Mac. You could have explosive diarrhea uncontrolled when you happen to be teaching in front of, you know, sixth graders or something.
Oh, boy.
So that's the problem.
Okay.
But people say that it helps you learn that you don't do that. But so
it literally is a fat dissolver and it just comes out.
Well, what happens is that normally fats are incorporated into our stool. So instead it just sort of passes through and we don't incorporate them very well. And so they just, so instead of making that trip through our hips, it just sort of passes through.
Okay, so basically if I look at something that can help me decide how many calories I'm burning and stuff like that and just watch intake and balance that with what you said, energy burning or whatever.
Right.
Then
so you want to eat less than you use up.
Right, okay. And so then that just go kind of a slow method as opposed to trying to get it all within 3 months, something like that.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Thanks for your help.
All right. We have maybe about 5 minutes left on this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the program every other month, and we talk about women's health. So if you have questions, you can give us a call.
But it is true that there are a number of medications that they are looking at for research purposes to see if we can't do something for the rising obesity problem in the United States. You know, 30 pounds, we don't know. She could, you know, be 7 feet tall and 30 pounds is nothing. But, you know, she might only be 4 or 5 and 30 pounds may really put her significantly overweight. But we know that that we've got to do something, and some of the new diet medications that they are working on research basis are really quite amazing. And some of the people that are working in this area of medicine even have optimism that they're going to even do better than bariatric surgery. So it's pretty impressive, because when we study the different kinds of things that are available, there are different hormones that they're studying that can help us release the gut peptides that make us feel full as we eat. So there are some pretty interesting things. Okay, I forget what other topics we were going to talk about. I know
you said that maybe there was something new in the way of contraception.
Contraception. So there was the new approval of Librel, which is one full year of an oral contraceptive pills. Doctors have been doing this for a while. And the upside is that for some women, they'll be able to take a pill every single day and actually not have periods. And it's healthy because no lining tissue does build up inside the uterus because of the way the dosage is formulated. And the downside is that for some women, they will have irregular spotting, which is annoying, even though they won't have regular periods. But it is newly approved. We were in that research study, and many of our patients felt that did very, very well on that pill. And so we were excited to be part of something that was newly approved.
So how long can you go not having periods?
As long as you stay on that pill.
And there's no problem connected with that.
What they do is they've lowered the total hormone dosage. Mm-hmm. And so the risks and benefits are pretty much like all other pills. Class effect is what you see.
Lawrence County, we have another caller here on our toll-free line. We want to get them before we still have some time. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I wanted to ask Dr. Trubin about the necessity for a Pap test after a hysterectomy. When the cervix has been removed, is that ever still necessary?
Well, they have changed the guidelines, and if you have never had an abnormal Pap and you had a normal hysterectomy, histology. In other words, if your doctor said that your cervix was completely clear at the time that you had your hysterectomy, many physicians have stopped doing Pap smears altogether. Now, the vagina can undergo some of those same precancerous changes. So some physicians have gone to just very infrequent Paps, like maybe 1 at 2 years or maybe every 5 years. And certainly if you develop any symptoms, any bleeding or any discharge, they do still do Pap smears. And if you actually have retained your ovaries, many physicians will still actually do a bimanual exam to feel the ovaries. But actually sampling the lining of the vagina, if you've never had any precancerous changes or have no other risk factors or never had any precancerous changes of the lining of the uterus, you do not need that after a hysterectomy.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Something I guess I thought I would ask you about real quick here in the way of news. We certainly have talked before about Gardasil, about the vaccine for human papilloma virus, and the recommendation that that girls or young women have this as a way of preventing cervical cancer. And I'm just asking because apparently now there is another company that is going to be offering essentially their version of what sounds to me like the same thing. It's called Cervarix, and it's not out yet, but it seems to be quite similar in terms of what it does, and both of them, you have to have 3 shots, and they protect against basically the same types of HPV. If we get to the point where this is now on the market, is there going to be any particular reason to choose one or the other, or does it?
It's
really
a great
matter?
Question, and I was in some of the early trials of that vaccine when it was owned by a different company. Gardasil covers HPV 6 and 11, 16 and 18. The GSK vaccine is 16 and 18. We think that it's 16 and 18 that will protect you against 70% of the cases of actual cervical cancer. So as a cancer protection, they might actually protect about the same. Now, they're both made with what's called different adjuvants, and this is where it starts to get very complicated. So there's things that make it a vaccine. So there are pieces of the virus that make it develop an antibody response, but there's these different adjuvants that make the antibody response potent, so that when you pick up a virus infection naturally, you develop some sort of antibody response. But when you pick up a antibody response to a vaccine, it's a little bit different. And in fact, with these vaccines, the antibody response is somewhat better, because when we're picking up the virus infection, we're picking it up through skin, and the vaccine, we're picking it up through blood, and with these adjuvants that actually make our antibody response better. So we're going to hear quite a bit of complicated information, and I have not yet seen the GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, new vaccine information yet. But we're going to hear a lot of complicated information about their vaccine and whether or not their antibody response is perhaps better, and whether or not even though they are against 16 and 18, whether they offer some cross-protection. They have looked at cross-protection against other types. So we're going to hear a lot of information, and whether or not one vaccine is going to be better than the other. And I am going to go to another global investigator meeting about the Gardasil, so I'll be hearing more about that. Also, they're going to be launching new trials that will incorporate more than just the 4 types of viruses. So you're right. We're going to hear a lot more about different ways to protect ourselves. The big thing also we're going to hear about is whether or not you're going to need boosters of these vaccines. We don't know. We know about other types of vaccines, whether or not we need boosters, like with flu shot. We need a new flu shot every single year. So are we going to need boosters of the Gardasil? We don't know this yet. So there's a lot more information, and it will be made public. I mean, there's going to be quite a bit of interesting medical discussion about it.
Yeah. One other thing real quick, again, maybe you could say something general here that would be useful. Earlier, a couple months ago, there was a study that came out from the National Institutes of Health looking at the cost of treating urologic disease in the United States. And the thing that really impressed me was we're spending a lot of money on this. And the big thing was, according to them, in the year 2000, we spent almost $3.5 billion treating urinary tract infections. So I was thinking, well, is there something you could say real quick about anything that women could do particularly to lower their risk of urinary tract infection?
Well, they could stop having sex, David.
Okay, well, short of that.
Short of that, we do need to do better. We need to have less infections. We need to get better spermicides. It is associated with condoms, sexual activity, use of diaphragms, all associated with increased risks of urinary tract infections. And again, get symptoms treated promptly, get them properly eradicated. I think all of this is going to improve, get better medicines out there. But you're right. Something expensive to treat.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for being
here. Thank
you. We appreciate it. Dr. Suzanne Troopin, she is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. That's the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She also teaches at U of I Med School. And every other month, on a Monday, she is here, and we talk about women's health.